Small Biz America.
I am David Wolf, your host. Hope you had a great week in your business. We're going to be talking once again with four compelling guests for the hour. We have Maureg Barrett. She'll be coming up soon. She's the author of Cultivate, The Power of Winning Relationships. We'll talk about the four relationship types that exist in your workplace and much more. Ron Stahel will be joining us. He's an author of six novels ranging from coming-of-age comedies to supernatural thrillers. He's a fascinating guy. We'll get some insights about both the creative process and the business of publishing from Ron Stahel. Jay Bean, he's the CEO of Freshline. This is a marketing platform and engine dedicated to driving repeat revenue and building customer relationships for small businesses. And of course, the Small Biz Brain with Gabe Arnold. Maureg Barrett is with us. She's the CEO of a leading HR consultancy called Sky Team and the author of Cultivate, The Power of Winning Relationships, an in-demand consultant and speaker with more than 25 years experience in all kinds of coaching and developing high-impact teams across Europe, America, and Asia. And I'm happy to welcome Maureg. Welcome to the program.
I'm looking forward to our conversation.
No, this is great stuff because it gets into the emotional intelligence and how we communicate. So let's dig right in. Maureg, you talk about four relationship types that exist in the workplace. What are the four relationship types and why is it important that we think in these terms?
Well, let's start with why is it important that we think in these terms. So in my career, my first career, I spent 15 years in commercial finance where I was told it's not business, it's business. And I realized very quickly that we're quick to point fingers and ascribe blame when things don't go to plan. And so my mindset is now that actually it is personal and that in business you can't be successful unless you are also successful in cultivating winning relationships. And that's where the four relationships dynamics come in to play, because I wanted to provide a language and framework for diagnosing the health of professional relationships that move us forward to constructive action versus finger pointing and blame. So in my book, I describe the four relationships, and the two that really resonate with most people, firstly, are adversaries at the dark side of the relationship ecosystem, the ones where you might feel that others are out to get you. It's a continuously tense relationship. Maybe you're butting heads or you feel like you're being thrown under the proverbial bus. And at the other end of the spectrum, at the bright end of the scale, are what I describe as allies. Think of them as your best friend at work, the person who can champion you, but will also give you a swift kick in the pants if you need it and the feedback that you need to hear. So those are two of the four relationships, David, that I outline in my book that help people to understand, well, what do I need to do in order to transform and strengthen my working relationships?
And I would guess that by thinking in these, I'll call them compartments or across a spectrum of 4 points, you begin to be able to behave differently because you understand that this is a spectrum and they're very identifiable traits that that you can operate against or manage against. Do I have that right?
Yes. I mean, think about your allies, the listeners to this podcast. Who are the people who've helped you to get to where you are today? What is it that they've said or done that makes them immediately jump to mind as those go-to people? And what I'm espousing in my book is don't leave it as an implicit assumption that they know that you think of them as allies. Make it explicit. Tell them that you are their ally and acknowledge and thank them for the support that you've had. And at the other end of the scale, when you talk about changing behaviors, when we label somebody as being difficult, when we label them as adversaries, sometimes that can cause us to become stuck. So the title of adversary is describing the behaviors. But what I've learned in my career is very few people get up in the morning and hope that they can have a reputation of being an adversary. It's usually misaligned expectations, goals, personality, styles. But unless we have a conversation, unless I articulate how I'm finding it frustrating, nothing's going to change.
Exactly. And you say it is a framework for behavior, for thinking, and for inspiring change in the workplace. I was curious, do you feel that most of what you apply here applies to entrepreneurs, outside of workplace, but more solopreneurs?
Definitely.
As much as it would, like an environment or an ecosystem that's more of a closed system?
Definitely, if not more so. So Sky Team, we're nearly 10 years old, but it started with me as a solopreneur. And I would not have got to where I am today but for the professional relationships that I built with clients and with the subcontractors and with the marketing people that I would bring in, with all of those people and family and social. But the whole network of professional relationships that help you, whether you're a solopreneur or now as an entrepreneur with a team, or if you're working in a corporate environment, this is a game changer. It really does matter.
Beautiful. Thank you, Morag. You have said that being nice, or why being nice, is not good career advice necessarily. Elaborate on this a bit, if you would.
Well, this goes back to the four relationship dynamics. And one of the ones that we haven't touched on is what I describe as a supporter. I liken them to fair weather friends. They're your champion and cheerleaders when things are going well. But when things get tough, they disappear. Unlike an ally who will be right with you on the good days and bad days. And the difference between a supporter and an ally is a supporter tells you the feedback you want to hear, i.e. they're nice. Whereas an ally will tell you the feedback you need to hear, i.e. they are kind. So even if the message is a tough message, an ally will step up and let you know so that you can choose to take alternative action. And that's why I believe that being nice, which we're all brought up to be nice and polite, gets lost in translation, because we believe that in a work environment, being nice means that we don't talk about the elephant in the room. We don't ask for different. We go along. And of course, that can sometimes just perpetuate the toxic behaviors or the unhelpful behaviors that ultimately mean that we don't meet our goals and don't deliver our results.
It sounds like it runs right up against truth and transparency, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Bragging rights, of course, this sounds a little unusual, but let's dig in. So bragging rights, the fine art of self-promotion. Now, I've never been afraid of self-promotion. I worked in the music business. I'm here on the radio, so I get it. But for our audience, they're in business. What does this mean for them?
Well, I've fallen into this trap myself, and it's when people come along and go, oh my goodness, you're so successful. Oh my goodness, you just did a fabulous presentation, or oh my goodness, you've just done this great campaign. And for many of us, it goes back to being nice. We're taught that it's not polite to brag, and so we go, oh, it was nothing. Oh, don't mention it. We downplay our contributions.
Oh, right, now, right. It's like a self-effacing behavior. Sorry to step on you. It's like a self-effacing.
Go ahead,
please. Yeah.
So self-effacing. So we're humble, but sometimes being humble can actually undermine our credibility. And so in terms of tooting our horn, I'm not suggesting that you turn the dial right up to 10 and we start being misperceived as arrogant just out for ourselves. But I think the next time that your listeners receive a compliment, don't just brush it off and say it was nothing. First of all, say thank you. And then expand a little bit, ask questions, but share just how much work and effort and thought and time has gone into whatever it is that others are complimenting you on. So there is a fine art to being able to toot your horn, to share your successes in a way that builds confidence in others and therefore drives revenue and customers, versus downplaying it, which may mean it's a missed opportunity.
I love that. I love the finesse that you put around that in a reframe, really, because it's not bragging at all. It's just really sharing, and it's letting people know that, yeah, a lot of work went into this, and you don't have to immediately be humble. We got about a minute and a half for this segment. Specific phrases and strategies to start and end important networking and workplace conversations, if you will.
Well, every relationship workplace has to start somewhere. And many people come to me for advice on how do I network. And what seems to happen is they worry about how to keep conversations going and to talk to strangers. So the easiest, quickest piece of advice is start with hello and let the conversation unfold from there. We don't need to spend too much time practicing in advance.
Nice. Don't need to rehearse. Morag Barak. She's the CEO of a leading HR consultancy. The company's called SkyTeam. The website, www.skyteam.com. You can follow her on Twitter at Sky. That's SkyeMorag. And, of course, the website also is SkyeTeam.com. Morag, such a pleasure to have you. Good luck with the book. I guess it's available anywhere and everywhere, right?
It is available anywhere and everywhere, digital and hard copy. Thank you, David.
Oh, beautiful. All right, we'll do it again for sure. Morag Barak, such great stuff, because we need to understand how to work together. We have to get along together in the workplace. Next up, we've got Ron Stahl, fascinating guy. He's an author. We'll talk about the business of writing novels and how it connects to our creative mind. He's a drummer and a guitarist. This should be interesting. 17 past the hour. Don't go anywhere. Small Biz America. Our next guest writes with a passion driven by a desire to share his stories and is particularly skilled at bringing the reader into the world he has created. The characters are vivid and likable, and, well, most of them are quite vivid and likable anyway. He's written six novels, from the coming-of-age comedy ranging up to supernatural thrillers. His latest work, Extreme Options, is a fast-paced detective murder mystery. Ron Stahl, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you. Some have said that you started writing very late in life. What prompted the change for you? What were you doing before, and how did you move into writing?
Oh, I retired from the Navy in 2001. I'd always been a creative spirit. Growing up, I read comic books and watched all the things that heroes are made of, so it was always a core part of me. I read many, many books in the Navy, and then I decided to get on Facebook back about 2008, and over the time, I started developing what I call the short pause, which is where I would give inspirational messages every day, hoping I could help someone out there that were in need. It was a passion of mine, and my wife one day just looked over at me on the couch and said, "You know what? You need to write a book. I think you have a gift." And I said, "Okay, you're in charge, so I'll do that." So I sat down and wrote about what I was familiar with, which was growing up in the 60s. I wanted to show what it was like for kids to be able to grow up without having to use their thumbs. And a book was written in about 7 weeks, about 300 words. And once I realized that it was that easy for me, not including editing monsters and things like that, I was able to not stop. I just kept writing one book after the other.
And as you think about the work you're doing, Ron Stahl, the books represent many different genres. What's it like switching modality into these different characters, these different scenarios, and does one seem to resonate with you more than any of the others?
I'm coming up with a new phrase that I haven't really been using, but the last couple of interviews I've done, I'm like the John Wayne writer, in that no matter what character John Wayne played, it was John Wayne, right? He was always the same persona,
right?
No matter who he was playing.
Exactly. He brings himself to the role. That's right.
Whatever book I write, it's the same type of book as any, even though it may be going from a supernatural thriller to a murder detective mystery to a coming of age. All my books are infused with what I call my style of comedy. Even the very scary parts, or, you know, the murder mystery parts that are shocking, there's still going to be humor all throughout it. So none of the books have actually been an issue for me to come up with a story. It is a 100% gift, I believe, that I was laid dormant until I awakened it. And so each one of my books has my flavor. If you read my books, you expect to see what you're going to see. And people who have read my books say that even though it's a completely different style of book, it is, you can still tell it's me by the way the characters interact.
I love that. I mean, and as you say, an actor would like, I mean, many actors are very able to. Gene Hackman comes to mind as well, where they kind of show up like who they are. It's their voice transmuting, if you will, through a character that you create. I'm still amazed at anyone who can create all these different characters and have them interacting and having their own lives. I mean, lives of their own. And that's what you do when you do the work you're doing now. Tell us about the comedic thriller, Ron. This is what you're calling your Bryce Mallory series. Is that right? Talk a little bit about this.
Correct.
One.
Well, and what it is that you'll, you know, the scene opens with a serial killer with his victim, and it's not graphic, but it's definitely Alfred Hitchcock issues. So your imagination is going to go, what happens as soon as the next page happens? I leave you on a cliffhanger. But then the next one talks about Bryce and his wife trying to figure out how they're going to get dinner. And these are Irish Americans, so I write with a brogue. So, you know, they're going, is it calling me the dullards name yar? You know, they interact with each other, Seamus and Bryce and his wife and the people that are close to him. They have that kind of comedic thing going on all the time. Are you calling me out? Yeah, I'm calling you out. That kind of thing. So even though the book is going to be, it's going to be scary at some points and thrilling, you're still going to have that comedic imprint. So I call it a comedic thriller because when I get my reviews, you'll have one person saying, I never laughed so hard, but it scared the hell out of me. So it's kind of a mixed match. So I didn't know. I thought maybe this is something a little bit new. I know Stephen King. I'm not comparing myself, but he makes me laugh out loud sometimes when I read his books, and especially the older ones, just by the way he's flavoring up the character. So akin to that, that's probably the best way to make it associate with someone.
And you're talking about constructing dialogue between characters, which really suggests, you know, real relationships between them. Well, how do you construct dialogue? Do you actually say it out loud, or do you play the parts as an actor, or does it all happen internally for you?
It's like here it is. I sit down with the page, and then there is somebody in my head that dictates to me. It is actually just comes out of me. I think a lot of writers will tell you they don't know where they're going, but I guess I'm envisioning the group talking to each other. And then I just throw out the language and decide which character is going to put it there. If I knew how I did it, I guess I would be amazed because it is, again, a gift. I think if you have that gift, maybe because I've read probably 3,000 books, it's easier for me. I'm not sure. I don't do an outline. I don't look in the future. I couldn't tell you how a book's going to end 3/4 of the way through it, but I just keep plugging away and it happens.
Well, that's really interesting. I mean, in other words, you're doing what we call a music through composing, right? So you're actually writing from beginning to end and allowing the story to organically unfold. Is that right?
Absolutely. That's perfect. I call it driving at night with your headlights. I don't see beyond the headlights, but I'm going to get to the end.
Yeah, that's another way of putting it. I love that. Yeah. But it's throughput. I mean, you're not really planning it like an architect would, you know, where you've got a structure and you're not engineering the story and backing into it. Yeah.
No, it's all off the cuff.
That's really interesting. Now, you're a musician as well. I mean, I'm a musician, as I told you offline, so I understand that creativity is kind of creativity. But talk a little bit about the creative mind. And then in the last couple minutes, I do want to talk about the business of what you do as well. But what's the cross-pollination between your music brain and your verbal brain, shall we say?
Well, every passion I've ever had has had something artistic, so I know that that's who I am in my soul. And I grew up with the original 60s and 70s rock and roll, and I was in bands and played guitar, and then I picked up the drums and did that as well. So it was something that made me feel good, and it helped me to get through the day, as it were. The music was what I used to fight off all the other mess. And that seems to be the same thing with the writing. It's the same kind of mind that... from the music and the writing is that, because I would write my own songs. I never learned to read music at first. I just was able to start playing by ear. So I think that correlates in some way that you have a gift of creativity, if it were, something that you didn't really go out and earn, but you were blessed with. So I do think they're both two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, and we did talk about this way you write, which is from top to bottom. So it's like improvising with the pen, or in our case, the typewriter, listen to me. That dates me a little bit. Great stuff. I did want to ask just in the final minute as we close out, Ron Stahel, the business of writing books, are you self-publishing, or how did you approach sort of the distribution and the business side of all of this?
I paid a publisher the first time to help me, and then I after that I decided I could do this myself, so I did self-publishing for 4 of the books, and then I've had... 2 publishers working with me now on different genres. So I've actually got publisher and a publicist now. So I've crossed over to that line, and I'm grateful for that. But yeah, you can self-publish if you really want to do it. That's easy to do.
It's easy to do. Ron Stahel. What's the website people should go to for the books and the writing you're doing?
RonStahel.com. I'm a domain. That gives you all the links and everything you need to know in videos.
All right, and Ron spells his last name S-T-E-L-L-E, just so you know, R-O-N-S-T-E-L-L-E. You can follow him on Twitter. He's got an underscore between his two names. Ron, thanks so much for joining us on the program.
Thank you very much for having me. You have a great week.
absolutely enjoy. Next up, we've got Jay Bean. He's the founder of Fresh Lime, and we'll find out what he's doing. Don't go away. 30 minutes past.
It's time for another PR and SEO quick tip with Melanie Rembrandt. Melanie, how do I use Twitter and Facebook for my small business?
Well, David, the big buzz these days is to use social marketing to boost sales and communicate with customers. But before you jump on that bandwagon and start using sites like Twitter and Facebook, first you need to figure out why you want to use these sites and the results you're hoping to gain. Also, you need to find out if your target market is actually using these sites. Otherwise, you'll just end up wasting a lot of time and effort. So then if you decide to move forward with a Twitter account, a Facebook page, or other social media sites, have a plan of action. It can be really exciting to start something new, but then let it slide as other priorities come up. But with these social media sites, you want to be current and provide valuable information on a regular basis. And it's really helpful to assign someone to be in charge of these pages and monitor results daily. This way, you can track your progress and make necessary changes to meet your goals.
Want to boost sales fast with public relations and search engine optimization? Listen to PR and SEO Quick Tips with Melanie Rembrandt and visit RembrandtWrites.com/radio for your free newsletter, exclusive tips, and more.
Small Biz.
Small Biz America.
Jay Bean, he's the CEO of Fresh Lime, a marketing platform and engine dedicated to driving repeat revenue and building customer relationships for small businesses. Jay's been focused on understanding the world of marketing for small business for more than 16 years. Let's get his perspective now. He's joining us from Austin, Texas. Jay, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Good to be with you. You have said that for most small businesses, 50% of their marketing spend is bringing them a good ROI, and the other 50% is a total waste of money. What are companies wasting their money on?
They're wasting their money on normal advertising that should be bringing them good results, but they're not able to track the actual advertising spend and the efforts that they're doing all the way to a customer transaction. So some of those efforts, it could be SEO or paid search or banners or other things they may be doing online, maybe bringing them users or click-throughs or visitors, but not real transactions. And so knowing that is kind of a key way of knowing where to put your time and efforts to drive the best results.
So, Jay, as you work with your clients, companies that you're helping them with marketing with around the planet, where are you focused on them spending for them?
So we actually help them see which marketing efforts are the ones that are producing value. And so how we do that is we will take their offline transactions, for example. So they may be using QuickBooks or FreshBooks or another accounting software. We help them sync that data with their customer data and all the way back to their marketing efforts. And so now when they run a Google campaign or run a Facebook campaign, we can actually show them where their customers are coming from all the way to money coming into their pocket. And so this allows them to see which of those efforts are not producing the results. And so we're not necessarily trying to change their behavior and where they're spending dollars. We're giving them the valuable data they need, the understanding around who their customers are and best customers, so they can make a better educated guess when they're actually starting to run campaigns. Because we know it costs a lot of money and it takes them a lot of time. And if they knew exactly, if they had that magic ball to show them what is going to work best, then they would probably put those efforts and money into the right areas, and we help them do that.
Yeah, you guide them by using the real data, the actual behaviors that have happened historically, and then frame it out for them so they understand where to spend. I want to cover a couple of subjects here. There's so much to do. You've had a varied career. You've been involved with a company called Aha.com and, of course, Orange Soda. So I wanted to ask you sort of the broader question, since we don't have a whole lot of time here today. What did you take away from, let's just say, the Aha.com, and then maybe we can take Orange Soda separately if you like?
Really good question. I mean, I think when I started Aha, I was pretty young, and I didn't really understand the value of building a business and kind of networking. And I think probably the biggest thing I took out of there was, even though I was building an online business, I found that my offline connections and people that I could really rely on and ask questions and kind of gain knowledge so I didn't make the same mistakes that others had made was the most valuable thing that I took out of that business.
Wow. What did AHA do, AHA.com?
AHA was actually one of the it was one of the early pay-per-click search companies. It was a great company. We grew in 3 years from kind of startup to in the mid 30 millions of revenue.
Amazing. What was Orange Soda? What did that company do, and what was your sort of lessons learned?
So Orange Soda was, we really helped locally focused businesses transition from traditional Yellow Page and online, I mean, offline advertising to online. And so we were a large SEO company. We partnered with a lot of the biggest aggregators, the big Yellow Page companies and newspaper companies. And so we were their core platform when they would sell SEO or paid search to many of their small business customers. And I think from that experience, the thing that I learned was I learned a lot about small business. Even though AHA was focused around small business, I spent days every single month in small business dental offices and plumbing shops and retail stores. And I really got a great understanding around small businesses and their needs. And that kind of really led me to, after exiting that business, to where I'm at today and helping them in the small business in a much different way.
Yeah, really helping them with the behavioral or transactional metrics, taking actual data and engineering a plan that's effective. If I were to ask you how online advertising has changed since you started in the space, be it pay-per-click or otherwise, how would you answer?
Actually, that's a really good question. I think we've gone through many evolutions from banner advertising to paid search to search and optimization and mass optimization and all these things. And display is back today, but in a different format. I mean, retargeting. So what I've seen is the marketplace continues to evolve over and over and over again. But I think really where we're getting to today is it's the attribution. I mean, it's around spending a dollar on advertising and knowing how I'm going to make $8 out of that or $5 out of that. And that really didn't exist until it existed in the online to online world, but the online to offline world has not existed until really now.
The online to offline world. So in other words, acquisition online and then drive them to a location. Is that what you mean?
Drive them to a location, and that location may be a retail store or an office building, or it may be a transaction that happens in someone's house when the plumber comes over to install a new water heater.
Yeah, so there's a loop to close as you describe this, as I'm visualizing it. Do I have that right?
Yeah, it's the biggest loop because we think about how big e-commerce is, and there's lots of solutions on the e-commerce side, but e-commerce only represents 7% of all transactions. 93% still happen offline, and it's closing that offline transaction loop and attributing value to wherever that source of lead or customer came from is the vital thing that is important today, and that's really what's going to drive marketing in the future for a great extent.
Jay Bean, do you have any advice for folks contemplating or using pay-per-click, just sort of high level about how to approach that? This may be a tough question to fit in the last couple minutes we have here.
I mean, I think all forms of advertising, it doesn't really matter if it's paid search or if it's SEO or if it's social. I think that business owners need to have an objective. It's not about just showing up. It's what do they want to accomplish and what are the goals that they're setting for those marketing methods. And then utilizing whatever they can to drive towards that goal. I think just the whole idea of showing up and saying I'm a really good hairstylist, or I'm a really good plumber today, or I run an awesome sunglass store is not enough. I think customer service and how we engage our customers and how we stay engaged with them is vitally important. So it's not a matter of how we attract them, it's how we keep them. And I think that's one of the pieces that's changing.
Yeah, sorry to step on you. Yeah, the retention part seems to be a focus for marketing companies now. I've got a client myself in the automotive space, and there's the whole follow-up that automatically talks to a customer about when they should get their next oil change, et cetera. This retention thing has become huge because the cost of getting a new customer is far greater than the one you already have. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. It costs 5 or 6 times more to get a new customer than retaining an existing customer. But retaining an existing customer, you need to have 3 to 5 touch points with them on a yearly basis. And it's not about just selling them something new. It's around building a relationship.
Okay, good. Jay Bean, the website, www.freshlime.com. Freshlime.com is the website. Jay Bean has been our guest. He's the CEO joining us from Austin. You're at an event there. Jay, thanks so much for joining us on the program.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. Enjoy. It's 46 past the hour.
Small Biz.
Small Biz America. The brain.
That's right. It's time for the Small Biz Brain. As always, joining us, he's the founder of CopywriterToday.net, an expert in email marketing automation and sales, and marketing business consultancy, and of course, our recurring guest. He is the brain, one and the same, Gabe Arnold. Gabe, welcome back.
Thanks, David. Glad to be here.
So today, we're going to cover some tips on blogging, and this is really basic stuff. Talk to us about how to write a successful blog post, if you will, please, sir.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that, you know, I see a lot of businesses struggle with is, you know, blogging consistently and blogging successfully. And one of the reasons that it's important is because having fresh, valuable content out there for your audience and for search engines to pick up and to be able to share on social media, there's just so many important, you know, valuable purposes for, you know, blog content. But mm-hmm. when I sit down with people, you know, they struggle with how to structure that and how to do it successfully. And so there's a format that, you know, I always recommend that's kind of a nice basic format to start with that will help you get on the right track and create something, you know, valuable and successful. And that's what I want to share with everybody today.
Beautiful.
One of the things that you always want to do is there's basically three pieces that we'll cover here. You want to open with what we call the empathy opener. Number two, then you want to give incredible value. And number three, you want to close with a call to action. And so we'll just walk through, you know, each of those, you know, briefly so that it kind of gives everybody kind of a structure of what to follow.
Perfect.
So opening with the empathy opener is just basically a tactic where you want to, you know, think about where your potential reader is at when they're reading that, you know, when they're reading your post and how they may be feeling. And so if I was writing a blog post for somebody that struggled with writing blog posts, I would open up by saying, you know, you've probably been there before. You sit down to write the perfect blog post and you open up Word and you start, you know, you click on the page and the cursor just sits there and it flashes at you because you have no ideas.
completely glazed over. Of course, that's never happened to me.
Right.
But I like this because you're sort of telling a story in an empathetic way. You're saying, you know, and it unfolds for them in a way that they can relate to.
Exactly. Because that first line or two, you know, and definitely that first short paragraph of that post is one of the deciding factors of if somebody's going to read the rest of it. Obviously, you need to have a catchy headline, and we actually have a free tool for that on our site if somebody wants to go check that out. So have a catchy headline about your topic, but then the first few lines that you write, it has to catch the attention of the person that's, you know, browsing it so that they can go, oh, David knows exactly what I'm talking about, or Gabe knows what I'm talking about, or whoever, you know, is authoring the post, like, they understand me. So the empathy opener is your first opportunity to bond with the reader. So you need to phrase it and talk about it in a way that they're like, oh, they understand that I struggle with this, or they yep. know what, how I'm feeling, and then yep. they dive in. So that's the glue that sticks them first. then the middle piece of your post is pretty straightforward, and you know, but it's always just really important to be really objective and focused on this is provide incredible value. So a post that gives after you've done the empathy open and then you walk into like the step-by-step of how to accomplish the goal that you stated to the reader that they could accomplish. Like if your subject or your headline was, you know, 10 ways to launch a blog in 24 hours or whatever the topic would be, then you get into the meat of the post and you really, you know, dive into and dissect step-by-step how to pictures, videos, you know, just break it down. So it's really, really valuable. The middle part is fairly straightforward. Just share your already existing expertise or knowledge that you already know about your industry or your area of expertise.
And part of what I'm picking up as you talk about this middle section, Gabe, is the get into the details. Don't be afraid to dive down deep into the details about what you know, maybe to a tactical level. Am I reading correctly between the lines?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, think about it like this. If a doctor wrote about how to perform heart surgery and they went into step-by-step detail, they wouldn't lose any patients. All they would do is prove to their audience that they really knew step-by-step in detail how to accomplish the task. Sometimes people are afraid of giving away the secrets or giving away all their value. And that's really a fear that you need to set aside, because if you show your expertise, then when people do need you and your expertise, they'll remember that you're the one that actually knows how to do it.
That's right. You're establishing yourself as an authority by, even if they don't understand all the details, they're going to get that you've got the vernacular, you understand what you're talking about, and that you have a deep understanding for what you do. So good stuff.
Yep.
All right.
Exactly.
And then continuing.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the last thing is just don't be afraid to put a, you know, soft or strong call to action at the end and mix those up. So a soft call to action could be, you know, click here to download my ebook and, you know, get the more in-depth guide, or, you know, use this form to book an appointment in my calendar so I can give you a one-on-one consultation. Or, you know, if you sign up today, you can get 30% off the service, you know, and this will help you solve the problem. So always include a call to action, always include a way to be contacted, because so many people create great value and put it out there and they have a popular post, but they really weren't aggressive at all in, you know, providing a call to action. And if you're not doing that, then you're wasting your time blogging just as much if you didn't open with an empathy opener. All these pieces are really critical to success.
Well, this last piece, you know, it translates to real life face-to-face business too. I've heard smart people say that are in sales, ask for the business. Don't forget to just ask for the business. And that's really what you're saying here. Do you have a feeling about discounting versus free versus, you know, just the sort of, I'll call it the value exchange part of this, of offers, be them Tripwire or otherwise?
Yeah, that needs to be a business strategy level decision. And so a lot of people will say, you know, we don't offer any discounting, and that's fine if that's your approach. And there's a lot of thought process, you know, that I agree with behind that, like that if you're discounting, you may be cheapening your service.
Mm-hmm.
However, like a free download or giveaway starts the relationship. So that's something you definitely want to do. You want to start the conversation. And then the last thing I would say is that discounting is a perfectly, you know, successful strategy. People always love getting a discount. So that's kind of a big business strategy pricing, you know, question. I do all three, honestly.
Got it.
You kind of have to look at your overall model.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And for more information about Gabe and the work he does with his team, copywritertoday.net. copywritertoday.net. Gabe, as always, thanks for joining us on the program. The golden quote: when everything seems to be going against you, remember that the airplane takes off against the wind, not with it. And I'll leave you with that quote from Henry Ford. Have a good week in your business. I'm off next week. We'll have a repeat, and then we'll join you the following week with a whole new array of guests. That's it for Small Biz America on Biz Talk. Have a good one.